From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Hunting may be one of the oldest human activities, but with our increasingly urban existence, our markets full of food, and our growing reverence for nature, why in the world does anyone still hunt? This hour, some answers. We'll hear from some dedicated hunters as we fly with a falcon, track wolves in the wild, and chase deer.
Come on out, Bambi. It's safe now. We don't have to hide any longer.
What happened, Mother? Why did we all run?
Man was in the forest.
Bambi is a parable, of course, a young male animal who loses his mother to a wicked human hunter. And I think there's a tendency to think of deer as these tender, beautiful animals and not as rats with antlers.
As professor of botany and environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin, Donald Waller studies the impact deer have on ecosystems. He's the editor of a recent collection of ecological essays, The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. He also studies the history of the ecological movement, its founders, and its long, close association with hunting. And Don Waller is a hunter. Steve Paulson sat down with him to learn about deer in the wild.
Deer are already doing a lot of damage on the landscapes. I started out in the early 90s studying impacts of deer on sensitive conifers, including Canada yew and northern white cedar and eastern hemlock. All three of those conifers have been hammered hard by deer. They're among deer's favorite food in the wintertime. And in particular, deer tend to hang out in hemlock and cedar stands, and sometimes called deer yards, where there's a little lower snow cover and some thermal protection from cold winds. And in those areas, it's very difficult for a slow-growing cedar or hemlock seedling to ever make it, just because the deer keep nibbling them off. So you actually get cessation of tree regeneration altogether, it appears, once deer populations exceed about 35 or 40 per square mile.
Now, hasn't this whole question of hunting and the ethics of hunting been a big issue for conservationists over the decades?
Indeed so, Steve. The ethics of hunting have had a fascinating history over the past 150 years in our country. And I think the United States is sort of in a unique position in that regard. Hunting has gone on, of course, for many centuries in Europe, and there was primarily the province of wealthy people, the aristocracy and royalty. And in fact, our own game law is derived from English common law, where the game belongs to the crown rather than to the people who own the land. And that's why today you have to buy a hunting license to hunt game. Plants belong to the land, the game and animals belong to the state, formerly the crown.
So what did some of the early conservationists say about hunting? John Muir, for instance.
Well, John Muir is someone who wrote lyrically about the beauties of nature and who enjoyed seeing wildlife in all of its forms. He was concerned, however, Muir was, with overabundance, with overpopulation. In particular, he felt the Western stockman had too many cattle and especially sheep in many of these montane environments that he loved so much. So John Muir spoke out against what he called mountain maggots, browsing down the hillsides and mountainsides to the point where they couldn't support a good amount of vegetative cover. He also became buddies with Teddy Roosevelt, a well-known hunter. He loved the fact that Roosevelt was an outdoorsman and interested in spending the night with him on top of a mountain, you know, at a time before he became president.
You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, arguably the greatest environmental president in American history and an avid hunter as well, and who seems to embody kind of both extremes of hunting. I mean, clearly someone who loved nature, but also someone who seemed to revel in taking down big game.
Teddy Roosevelt, yeah, is a fascinating character. And of course, he did represent a crucial, pivotal point in American history when we were turning away from wasteful and destructive market hunting with the end of the bison and the passenger pigeon as wild populations in the United States, and the sort of dawn of a new era of conservation with the dawn of the 20th century with bird protection and migratory animal protection efforts. Let me just read a little bit from Teddy Roosevelt. In hunting, the finding and killing of the game is, after all, but a part of the whole. The free, self-reliant, adventurous life with its rugged and stalwart democracy, the wild surroundings, the grand beauty of the scenery, the chance to study the ways and habits of the woodland creatures, all these unite to give the career of the wilderness hunter its peculiar charm. The chase is among the best of all national pastimes. It cultivates that vigorous manliness, for the lack of which in a nation, as in an individual, the possession of no other qualities can possibly atone. What that captures there is the real notion of sport hunting by an obvious enthusiast. Sport hunting is a fairly new phenomenon in some respects. If you think about hunting, of course, it has its basis, and it's a very old practice among humans in subsistence hunting.
Right.
Our Cro-Magnon ancestors and those before them were hunters. We think of humans as being the hunting primate, and we hunted other primates, including ourselves, as well as other species.
So if we take the story of these famous conservationists up a little bit closer to the present, we get to Aldo Leopold, who to some degree founded the modern conservation movement and was a pioneer in game management to begin with. What were his attitudes about hunting?
Leopold, for me, is the most significant figure in the history of conservation in the 20th century. And one of the reasons for that is that his attitudes towards hunting changed dramatically from his early years when he was a forester out in New Mexico and Arizona, happy to shoot game and extol the virtues of shooting game, and committed to exterminating what he called varmints, predators.
And there's a famous story of how he shot a mother wolf, and that moment apparently changed him.
And watch that fierce green fire die in her eyes. Yes, that essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, is, I think, one of the finest pieces of nature writing that you can find, and telling for the way in which it reflects Leopold's change of heart from being a sort of an unquestioning adherent to the idea that we should shoot wolves whenever we get the chance to understanding that wolves play a key ecological role in the ecosystem, and that without wolves, mountains live, as he put it, in fear of their deer.
You have spent your career studying botany and conservation. Why did you decide to become a hunter as well?
It's something I came to gradually. My studies of plant communities had, of course, taught me how heavily overabundant white-tailed deer were affecting the understory of forests and many other communities. But it was also a dawning recognition of the special role that predators play in most ecosystems. That is, we see a difference between systems that have predators like wolves and lions still present and those that lack these top carnivores. And it made me ponder the role of humans in the system and when we need to play the role of top predator.
So partly you're saying that, we live here in Wisconsin, and wolves have been reintroduced, but frankly, there are not that many wolves around. There are lots of deer. You're saying that humans need to step in to fulfill that role of predator.
Actually, Steve, wolves were not reintroduced. Wolves moved in from Minnesota and perhaps the UP of Michigan, and now number, we think, around 550 in the state of Wisconsin. We have, nevertheless, about 1.7 million deer and about 550 wolves. If each wolf eats 20 or 25 deer in a year, you can do the math and figure out that number of wolves will not be ecologically effective in controlling the numbers of deer. So humans, in particular, play a key role. We hit about 50 or 60,000 a year on the highways of Wisconsin. In a good year, we've killed as many as close to 400,000 deer in a hunting season. So you can see that humans are playing a far more dominant role with regard to deer in particular.
To come back to your own story of becoming a hunter, how do you hunt, with a gun or with a bow?
I'm a bow hunter. I didn't grow up in a family that did any hunting at all, and guns were something that in particular my mother forbade. But hunting for me is a challenge, and part of the fun of the challenge is having a piece of equipment that goes back a long time. And of course, a bow has been in the human arsenal for thousands of years. But I feel as though there's something about being a bow hunter, the longer season, the opportunity to be out at different times of day in the season, and the necessity of being close to your prey before taking an animal. That's important for me. Taking a walk in the woods is a different experience than hunting. Hunting requires you to become invisible, inaudible, unsmellable, in the case of deer. That's a real challenge. Most humans today don't know how to be inconspicuous. They don't know how to hide. And I think hunting, among the other things it's taught me, is that special quality of being a part of a system and being able to observe things without being observed yourself. And I think that's one of the many things that draws people to hunting.
But one thing about hunting is that the weakest deer are not necessarily being culled. I mean, it's often the strongest, the biggest deer. I mean, this is not survival of the fittest.
That's a very interesting point. The real object for many hunters these days is a big rack of antlers on a buck deer. That does create a different situation. Historically, natural selection favored the predator that could be efficient in killing animals that would sustain it, but also would sustain the herd that it was eating. And so we think of predators as often taking the young, the old, the sick. Human hunters prefer to take the healthy, the strong, the middle-aged. And
does that bother you?
It does bother me, actually. As I mentioned, the reason I became a hunter, in large part, is because I saw the damage that too many white-tailed deer were doing in the woods. And the logical extension of that concern is to shoot does and not to shoot bucks. And so when I hunt, I shoot for does. I don't hunt for bucks.
Do you think we as a society have romanticized nature too much? And maybe it's from some of the nature shows we see on TV. I mean, sort of the beautiful images of animals, you know, dashing across the plain. And, you know, there's maybe a little bit of killing, but it's pretty carefully rationed out so that we don't see that much killing in the nature shows. Is that a problem?
Talk about romanticizing nature and animals. I think Bambi is something we should start with there. Bambi is a parable, of course, written originally in German, to tell the story of a young male animal who loses his mother to a wicked, you know, human hunter and spends the rest of his time trying to survive the various damage that humans do to natural systems. And so many kids have seen the Disneyized version of Bambi that I think there's a tendency to think of deer as these tender, beautiful animals and not as rats with antlers, as a friend of mine has called them.
That's pretty harsh about the deer, isn't it?
Well, that's just it. We tend to sort of impose upon deer and other animals our own notions of the time. And these, of course, vary over time. I think deer are a beautiful animal. They're the only large animal most of us are likely to see. That's one reason why so many people feed deer in the north, not just to bait them for hunting, but also because it's a delight to see these beautiful animals. And again, I don't think hunters are hell-bent on killing every deer they see. Rather, they want to complete the circle of life and participate in that larger circle.
Don Waller is the editor of The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Deer, deer, here. Then there, 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 here, there, 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 everywhere. At dawn in fields and coniferous groves, bucks and does come alive in droves. Just when you think that the coast is clear, there in the road is a white-tailed deer. Them deer, they're here. Then there, 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 here, there, 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 everywhere. Them deer, they're here.
In 2003, writer Kim Hiss got a new job with the venerable sportsman's magazine Field and Stream. An avid outdoors woman, she learned about guns and firearm safety and decided to accept an invitation to go on a hunt. She told Anne Strangechamps what happened next.
I was an editor at Field and Stream, but I was in a very administrative role. And an invitation to a hunt came along through Field and Stream. It was a women's hunt offered by the NRA. They had asked the then editor of the magazine, Sid Evans, if he had a woman on staff who would like to try hunting. And he asked me if I wanted to go. And I was real wide-eyed at the time and said, let me think about it. I mean, I was up for it, but I needed to give it some thought because this is a big step.
So this wasn't a no-brainer like, oh, I'd love to go shoot something.
Not a no-brainer in any sense. I'm a big outdoors person. I love sailing with my father. I'm a big hiker. I'm a big backpacker. So the outdoors component of it, that was a no-brainer. But when you're sailing or you're backpacking, you're having a great experience. But when you're hunting, that experience is happening at the expense of a life. And that's a big responsibility. And that was something that I did not take lightly. What I basically came down to was that I'm a meat eater. I eat meat. I have all my life. But at the time, I had never taken responsibility for what was on my plate. I would go to the grocery store. I'd get something out of the meat department, take it home and eat it. I mean, there was no connection to where that came from whatsoever. And I thought, okay, this is an opportunity, if I'm going to be eating it anyway, which I always have, to acknowledge my place in the food chain. I've never killed anything before. Bambi was my favorite movie as a kid. I mean, my family was shocked I was going hunting at all. Basically, the entire experience was very out of character for me.
Were you afraid you'd freak out at the sight of blood, or afraid that you just would see a deer but not be able to actually take a shot?
You know, it was everything. I was afraid I'd see a deer and freeze, not be able to take a shot. I was afraid I would take a shot, but I'd freak out. It would be a bad shot, and then I'd wound something that I then wouldn't be able to recover and basically cause suffering. I was very nervous because I just didn't know what to expect.
So what happened when you finally saw a deer?
It was late morning. We basically, this is my guide and I, spotted a group of deer at the top of a hill. So my guide had me get into position, and there were two bucks in that group, and he helped me decide which one made the most sense. As I remember it, the group had kind of bolted and then stopped, so I basically had a very quick second if I was going to take the shot to do so, and I did. That was a 245-yard shot.
So that's a pretty long way.
It was a very long way. But I felt that I had scoped it in well, and I felt confident in the moment that I could take the shot, so I did. So that basically stopped the deer enough for me to run up the hill and take a second 170-yard shot, which dropped the deer in its tracks. And it was over that quickly. Once I got to the deer, saw that it was down, saw that there had been, if any suffering, it was extremely short because the shot was extremely clean. I was relieved that it had, I don't want to say worked out, because clearly it didn't for the deer. I mean, you are taking a life. It's a responsibility, but it had happened as cleanly as it could have.
Did you feel bad about what you had done, or did you feel like this was great, I'd like to do it again?
I had a very mixed reaction to it, which was very much at odds with the reaction my guide had. My reaction was very sober. Once I got to the deer, we knew that it was dead. Again, there was this feeling of relief, but there definitely was sadness mixed in. I did cry a little. I kind of cradled the deer. It was a very odd reaction from me. I was really trying to come to terms with it. So it was kind of a somber moment of relief mixed with regret, mixed with, clearly it's a difficult feeling to describe.
How did your guide react?
Well, that's the thing. The guide, on the other hand, is very used to experiencing in his clients that kind of rush, adrenaline, pumping reaction that some hunters do experience. So he pulled a truck around, slipped in a CD, and cranked up Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, and started cranking stadium rock for what he assumed for me was this moment of, you know, adrenaline, triumph. But he was really expecting one reaction from me, and I had one that was positive, negative, regretful, a little pride mixed in, a little relief mixed in. There was a lot going on at the time.
Have you gone hunting since?
I have, many times. I think my first hunt after that, it was for duck in Oregon, which was a very different experience, and one that I'm not sure I enjoyed quite as much. In a duck hunt, you're using a shotgun, you're in a floating blind. And if a flock comes in, you shoot at the flock. In this case, a dog was running out into the water to retrieve the ducks and bring them back. And while I did enjoy being outside, I did like the process of getting the ducks and then bringing them home back to New York and having a big dinner with the ducks, with my friends and my family. And I enjoyed knowing where that meat had come from. Because you were shooting into a flock, I felt like it was easy to kind of disconnect from what you were doing.
Not as individual as looking at a single deer.
It was not as personal and intimate as an experience as the single deer had been.
You said one of the reasons you initially went hunting was you thought, well, you're a meat eater and, you know, you should have some experience of what it means to be willing to kill what you're going to eat. Have you found that hunting has changed your experience of eating?
I have. And I can say two things. The first is that there's a lot of meat in a deer. While my boyfriend and I initially were trying to make our way through all the deer meat in the freezer and very, you know, nicely make dinners of venison steaks with some amount of reverence for what we were eating that evening. We would always make an event out of eating the deer that night. In order to get through all that meat, we had to invite friends over for dinner, which was great. It kind of spun into a tradition where every time I got an animal, we would have a game dinner with all our friends, which was fantastic. So I do enjoy knowing where that meat came from and being able to share it with people I love and having them, even if they don't agree with hunting, appreciate the perspective of where this meat came from and kind of appreciate the eye-opener that I've experienced as well. If I do end up buying meat from the store, hunting hasn't changed my buying habits, but it does change the way that I eat meat from Stop and Shop or from Superfresh. I really took, you know, the turkey on my plate for dinner or the chicken in my sandwich for lunch out of context. There was no context for it. It just was there. I didn't think about it. As opposed to the ducks in Oregon, where I shot a duck, it falls to the water. A dog brings that duck to me. I put it in a cooler. I bring it back to New York, put it in my freezer, put it in a pan, and it ends up on the plates of myself and my friends. I know where that meat came from. And I think that's important to keep in touch with and not lose sight of.
Do you think your experience as a hunter, even a first-time hunter, was any different because you're a woman?
I'm not sure. I know some people say yes, some people say no. I had a very kind of tender, somber reaction to killing the deer, which I, you know, would think if you're going to subscribe to stereotypes, that would be a more female reaction. But on the other hand, I have talked to male hunters who, after a kill, don't take a photo of it, as many hunters do, because certain male hunters think, you know what, this is not the time for pictures. I just killed something. I'm going to field dress it and take it home and get it in the freezer. So I don't know. I don't know how much my reaction had to do with gender and how much it had to do with just my own disposition.
Well, I know this is something you think about, you know, women and hunting, gender and
certainly
hunting. I'm just curious, you know, is it just that hunting isn't something women have done a lot culturally, and so when they do step into the field and pick up a gun, they are going to be more thoughtful about it. There's going to be this sort of faint feeling that they're crossing a boundary. Or is there really something intrinsically, you know, innately gender-based about women's reactions to hunting?
Public perception tends to be more surprised to see a woman in the field than a man. I mean, there's really no way around that. It is a more arresting visual image, definitely, to see, you know, a female in the field with a rifle and a dead moose or a caribou. I mean, it certainly does go against that Bubba hunter stereotype that a lot of people are used to. It's interesting that historically that has not always been the case. 100 years ago, women were arguably more of a presence in the field and for whatever reason kind of dropped out, only to come back recently.
There were more women 100 years ago hunting?
Throughout the 20th century, there seems to have been a sort of relatively strong presence of women in the field, which seemed to have dropped off mid-century and now seems to be coming back. And this comeback is what a lot of people pick up on as seeing a surge in women hunters. But if you look back at the 1890s, you see a lot of women in the field. If you look in the pages of Field and Stream, women are a very strong presence to the point at which they're on the cover. There's a women's department. So around the 1890s, turn of the century, women were certainly a healthy presence in the field. It's really interesting to go back through those old dusty magazine archives and see a bunch of skirts in the pages of Field and Stream.
It's really interesting thinking about that 100 years ago, people didn't perceive a woman who hunted as the anomaly that we do today. Because I think, you know, today there's something that probably seems culturally a little off about the idea of a woman, say, putting down her nursing infant and going out to shoot a brace of rabbits.
Another part of that I can say is that I have met a number of women who do hunt while they're pregnant, which is a very interesting image and a very interesting meeting of a role of creation and destruction. And that's a whole other topic that I think obviously a man can experience, but a woman bringing a pregnancy into her field experience is very interesting to talk about.
What do the women say?
They say a whole bunch of interesting things. I've talked to women who sit in a deer blind and say that they don't feel their baby kick any other time more than when they're sitting and relaxed in their blind. It's when the mother says she's the most relaxed and she's the most self-aware, and that's when she feels the most activity from her baby, which is very interesting. Another common thing that I've heard from them is that they're excited to be initiating their child into this tradition of hunting, even in the womb, and they can't wait to take their kid hunting when they're old enough to do so. So there's a very strong traditional element in there as well.
Boy, there's something sort of archetypal about this image, though, don't you think? You know, woman giver of life and taker of life.
Absolutely.
I suppose it could make a woman feel incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. Of course, the patrons of hunting in both Greek and Roman mythology are both goddesses, Artemis and Diana. And interestingly, Artemis, the goddess of hunting, is also the patron of childbirth.
Kim Hiss is an associate editor and blogs as Huntress for Field & Stream magazine. She spoke to Anne Strangechamps. You can find a link to Kim's blog on our website. While you're there, drop us an email. Tell us your thoughts. So you won't have to hunt for our address. It's ttbook.org. Coming up, we go hunting for wolves. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Bob Stout, and I archery hunt in South Central Wisconsin. I hunt for sustenance and to fill the freezer, basically. And if I get a nice set of antlers out of that, then I'm happy about that. But I'm more pleased to lift the lid on that freezer and see that chock full of vacuum-packed meat. Well, archery hunting is very specialized. It's unhurried. You're out there by yourself. You get to see the animals in the act of being themselves. When you're up in a tree, instead of a two-dimensional arrangement where you're standing on the ground, you've got this third dimension. So you have to think spherically. It's not uncommon to watch an animal for 45 minutes or longer before you get a shot angle that you're satisfied with, that you know that you can get a good entry and exit wound. Exit wound is very important because that's going to leave your trail. You basically want to make a nice hole in the bottom of the deer. If the exit wound is high on the animal, you're not going to have any trail, any blood trail to follow. I'll look at the deer and I'll look at where I would like for the arrow to come out and then trace it backwards. And that's where I want to place my shot. Many times an arrow will go all the way through an animal and out to the other side, and the animal doesn't even realize it's been hit. They don't even blink. They don't flinch. Sometimes the animal will jump just slightly, just twitch. You don't know if the sound of the bow going off frightened the animal or if he actually got hit with the arrow. I go out and I okay, well, do I feel like taking an animal today? I like to make that decision right off the bat. That way I'm off the hook, because some days I just don't want to do it. I want to be out there hunting, but I don't want to take anything. Once I make that decision, then I can just really kick back and relax, and I don't have to be uptight about something showing up and not being prepared for it. I had a Jim Dandy 8-point buck and a yearling doe come in together one morning, and they bedded down right in front of my stand. I could have thrown a piece of paper or anything and hit them. They were just right there, right over the edge of my stand, and I could see them blink, they could see me blink. The buck was plenty big. In fact, I would have liked to have taken the yearling doe, But I had already made the decision that I just wasn't going to shoot. It's the mating season. They're together. And if either one of them would have been alone, I probably would have taken them. But I just wasn't going to break that up. I just let them go. They bedded down, and I got to witness what they do and how they sleep and how they watch and what noises disturb them, what noises don't. And the buck was kind of watching out for the doe. He was just taking care of her, and it was just a really interesting experience.
Bow hunter Bob Stout. What about the other predators in the forest? In some parts of the country, wolves and cougars are returning. Wolves are still protected by law, but there are people out there hunting them with cameras. Frank Bohl is the videographer of Wisconsin Public Television's Emmy Award-winning series Wolves in Wisconsin. He spent years trying to tape wild wolves in the field, first with a complex setup of motion-sensing, infrared-lighted, tree-mounted cameras, and got lots of images of raccoons and coyotes, but only brief glimpses of wolves. Frank Bohl explains some of the challenges of taping wolves in the wild.
Hunting a wolf with a camera is just like any other skills you use for hunting. You have to get into an area as quiet as possible. You have to be aware of where your scent is blowing. You have to be aware of how much noise you make getting in there. You have to be aware of what the setting looks like. If it's unnatural for the animal, he's not going to come close. So I was always aware of these things, but it's pretty much a roll of the dice. You go in into an area, and you know as you come in, everything downwind of you knows you're there, especially wolves. And then you sort of turn your back on that area in the blind because you know your scent is blowing down that way. They're not going to come out of that direction. So then you got three directions left to watch. And I was just lucky the third week and in January that two wolves came across a frozen lake.
But you were there. You were in the blind.
I was in the blind, and I had done this every weekend from Labor Day weekend until the third weekend in January. I had spent time at Nisida in a blind. And I had seen coyotes. I thought once I saw a wolf, but I wasn't sure. And I knew when you'd see them in a lot of cover, you'd just see them for a few seconds. And I thought, it's better than nothing, but I never had a good location. Nisida is hard to film at because it's pretty flat. There aren't many hills, and the brush comes right up to the road. So you don't have a good vista to see at a distance. I put up a tree stand, a revolving tree stand, from a hilltop on the east side of the refuge. And I could see a distance from there, and I saw two coyotes, and I saw a lot of deer, and I taped all of those. But I never saw any wolves up there. And I spent the first part of fall through, I think, deer hunting, the end of November, in that tree stand, and I never saw a wolf.
How many hours were you in a tree stand at a time?
I'd spend all day. I'd get there Friday night or early Saturday morning, and I'd get in a tree stand before sunrise, and I'd take it until I couldn't tape anymore at sunset.
How does that compare? Because I know you're a hunter as
yeah.
well. How does that kind of waiting compare to the waiting you would do with a gun in your hand?
It's basically the same. It's basically the same skills, the same patience. You have to dress for the weather that's there at the time. That's the real key to that. How much time can you spend in a blind or in a tree stand? It really depends on how bad that weather is and how well you dress. There's that old saying, there is no cold weather, it's just bad clothes. And that's pretty much the way I attacked every one of these assignments. For that day, I had to know what to wear, and I had to make sure I had it or else you can't stay, especially in winter.
What is it that the wolf senses about the camera and the setup that frightens him?
For about a week after I come in there and work on the camera, we hardly have any events from wolves. We always have events from raccoons and all these other critters. But the wolves know you were there because of the scent you left. It takes about a week for that to drift away. But the big problem with the camera in this weather enclosure is it makes a noise when it starts up and runs. It's not very much of a noise, but it's enough for a wolf to hear. Canines hear it where these other critters don't. Deer have never noticed the camera through noise. But wolves, you can tell when it's a real quiet day, when the camera starts up and there's no leaves moving, there's no wind, that wolf will stay for maybe 2 or 3 seconds because he hears the camera start up in the housing, and he usually looks right at the camera and then he disappears.
When you finally did get the lengthy footage of wolves, you were there.
Yes. That was a Saturday morning about 11 o'clock, and there was a small snow shower going through at the time. And I looked over to the southwest, and I noticed movement coming out of some brush, and I looked, and I could see it was a wolf, and I got the camera in position real quick, and I started taping. The problem with that wolf was it was snowing, he was a little far away, and he was going away from me. At the end of that shot, I thought, well, at least I got a wolf on tape. I stayed there until sunset, nothing else showed up. And then next day I went back, and again about that same hour, I saw two wolves coming across the lake, almost the same place where this one started from, but these were coming towards me. I was sitting in the blind looking out that north window, and I look back to the west over here, and I see two wolves coming across the frozen lake. And they actually started to come towards me. They came within 200 yards, I would suspect, and the lead wolf stopped and looked at the blind. All of a sudden, he took off, running straight to the north, and he looked over his shoulder as he's running. That's always a giveaway that they've seen you, and they're not going to get any closer. Sometimes I think they even notice that the blind is there, because I'm sitting on top of a hill, not a lot of cover around, and I think they know the country so well, their territory, that I believe they know when there's something different there. Would be sort of akin to coming home and finding another sofa in your living room. So I filmed them almost a complete circle on this lake, and I filmed them for 14 minutes. And then them noticing me was a big, I thought at the time, a disadvantage, but I think it was an advantage because it's what most people see when they're out hunting. This animal sees you and then gets away. And I think that really brought the viewer into the blind with me.
You spent 4 years trying to film wolves. You got 14 minutes of tape, but it was worth it.
Absolutely, because to me it was the biggest challenge I've ever faced, and I was hoping this would happen, that I would actually get to see a wolf and be ready with the camera, but there's no guarantee that would happen. I went back 3 weekends after that to the same location and tried it again for all those hours, and I never saw another wolf. I thought maybe they had been using this lake all winter long, and because I wasn't there, I hadn't noticed that. It was the luck of the draw that brought me to that hilltop for that weekend when they came out.
You've been a hunter. Can you compare the satisfaction of getting wolves on tape with the satisfaction of hunting a deer and getting your deer that season?
I think hunting with a camera is much more exciting, and I think it's more of a challenge. What I like about hunting with a camera is you don't pull a trigger, you don't stop the action. Whatever happens when that animal notices you, you are still on the hunt. Like I said, some of my best footage was after that wolf noticed me and then started to react the way it did and then ran away. I use footage from it running away as much as coming towards me. Where if you were hunting an animal, when that animal comes up there and you shoot it, that's it. That's the end of that adventure. That's why I prefer hunting with a camera, just because you get to watch it longer.
You've worked as a videographer. You've worked as a shooter with both gun and cameras. You've been a predator in both cases. Do you think of yourself as a predator?
When you ski into an area pulling all this equipment, you're aware that the noise you're making is probably chasing away everything downwind of you. So you have to be completely attuned to the environment you're going into when you're after wolves. I remember skiing down a trail in Nisida, middle of the day, going to check on one of my cameras, and I saw wolf tracks in front of me. It had snowed the night before, so I know these tracks were fresh. I got to the camera, and I worked on the camera, and I came out about an hour later, and I went back on my same ski tracks, and here were some more wolf tracks right over the ski tracks where I went in on. Those wolves were just curious, and I know they're off to the side watching me. This is the middle of the day. They were watching me. They had to be because they crossed my trail. And I'm thinking, they're certainly the top predator here. If they wanted me, I'd be dead a long time ago. Who's hunting who? Thank you.
Frank Bohl, videographer of Wisconsin Public Television's Emmy Award-winning series Wolves in Wisconsin. You can watch the series online. Just follow the links from our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, hunting the skies with a winged companion.
If I wanted to kill a lot of ducks, I'd get a shotgun. With a falcon, I'm happy if I take one. For me, seeing a great flight is everything.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Tina Bertoni. I had taken this 225-pound bear in northeastern Wisconsin along the Peshtigo River, and I was there with my two boys, who at the time were 7 and 11 years old. You only get a bear license in the area that we hunt once every 6 years. And the more I got to thinking, I thought, well, I think it would be kind of fun to take the boys up. They had off of school, so I thought that would be fun to take the boys up with me, and it'd be a nice experience for them. The boys, because of their age, were probably not going to do well sitting directly with me. So the boys sat with one of the people that we were staying with. They heard the shot. They definitely knew it was my shot. They came rushing down the hill. They were so excited, and we all walked in and walked up to the bear. It was a clean shot. It ran maybe 10 yards from where I was sitting, and my 11-year-old actually helped the gentleman carry it out of the woods, which was a task because it was a large bear, and it's deceiving. People think of, when they think of black bears, they think they're supposed to be as big as grizzly bears, and they're not. They're big, but they're not that enormous 6 feet tall, towering over you kind of bear. Bear meat is my by far favorite game food. The flavor and the texture of it, I absolutely love. It's not gamey at all. It is not at all what you think it would be. It sort of has the texture of pork, but the flavor of a really high quality beef. And my kids absolutely love it.
That's bear hunter Tina Bertoni. Tim Gallagher has always been fascinated with animals, particularly birds. He is editor-in-chief of Living Bird magazine at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and a world-renowned birder. In 2004, Gallagher and Bobby Ray Harrison reported their sighting of the nearly mythical ivory-billed woodpecker in the swamps of Arkansas, an experience Gallagher described in his book The Grail Bird. But some bird watchers might be surprised to hear that one of America's preeminent birders is also a hunter. In fact, a falconer. Tim Gallagher's been training hunting hawks since childhood, and he's written the memoir Falcon Fever about his life with birds of prey. Anne Strangehamps asked him about his current hunting companion, Macduff.
If Macduff was right here in the studio sitting on your fist now, what would we see?
Well, he's got a dark head. A peregrine has almost like a helmet, it looks like. You know, they're like, they call them mustache marks. It's sort of like the way a football player will put black on their cheeks so there won't be glare from the sun. When, you know, it's the same thing with falcons. When they're diving down on prey, they don't, you know, want to be blinded by the sun reflecting off pale cheek feathers. He looks almost like a jet aircraft or something to me because he's got these long pointed wings. He's really streamlined, and his whole back is this beautiful blue color. And his breast is a creamy color, but sort of with a wash of salmon color, and then with speckles down below.
Is he a big bird or a small bird?
He's about the size of a crow. He was bred in captivity by a friend in California. And he was pretty wild and spooky when I got him. He actually seemed wilder than some wild trap hawks and falcons I've had.
I think you described once, and when you were describing training the bird, didn't you write that you can't even look them straight in the eye?
No. You trap a falcon, you never look at it. To a predator, if you stare at something, the fixed stare of another animal usually precedes an attack, so they expect to be attacked if you stare at them. Because they're not social animals, they have no concept of dominance and submission, and you can't force your will upon a falcon. You sort of have to come to them hat in hand, you know, even if you're an emperor or a king. It's an unusual kind of training relationship. You know, you can't force it to do what you want.
So falconry is kind of an anachronistic pursuit. What got you interested in it? What drew you to it?
Well, I guess it wasn't so much that I was drawn to some ancient sport so much as that I really loved animals and particularly birds. And when I was young, I was always training things. And, you know, then I heard about falconry and I just thought, well, that's the ultimate in animal training. And when I did get interested in it, I went to a library looking for a book so I could learn how to do it. And the only one I found in the library was a 1942 translation of a book written by Emperor Frederick II, The Art of Falconry, or Hunting with Birds.
And this was written when?
It was written in the 1200s. And it's a huge, huge book. And I went to the library and checked it out, and I said, I'm going to read this whole thing.
How old were you?
I was 12. So I started reading this thing, and it was really dense, and I had to struggle with it. I kept going back to the library and renewing it, and finally the librarian got really mad at me and said, you know, you can't just keep checking this book out. You've had it 5 times already. And I opened it up, and I said, well, look, I'm the first person who's checked it out in 15 years. So she finally gave me this informal, agreement where I could just take it home indefinitely. And I had it for about a year and a half, and I read it from cover to cover, and then I went back and read the things I was really interested in.
What is falconry? Would you call it a sport, an art?
Well, for me, it goes beyond sport. Your goal is not to go out and take a head of game necessarily. It's the way you do it. You know, the beauty of the flight. The way I fly a falcon is called waiting on, where you get them to circle hundreds of feet above you, and then you'll flush game and they'll dive down on it. And I look at it like the whole sky is my canvas, and I'm trying to set up this work of art, and the bird has to finish it.
So the bird and you together are... Mm-hmm. Are the hunter, as though the two of
yes.
you together make up one hunter.
And that's what I love about it. It's the bond between a person and an animal, you know, a team, this almost strange, almost unnatural team working together, you know, this wild creature and this human. And it all depends on how good you are at flying them in a good place and getting them in the best physical shape and flushing the game at the right time. And they know how good you are. And if you're not good, and if you're not finding enough game, you're flushing it in the wrong time when they're out of position, they know it, and they just, you know, go off hunting by themselves. They get disgusted.
They sort of have contempt for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What's the relationship between the two of you like? Do you love him?
Well, yeah, I guess I do. It's funny to describe the relationship between a bird of prey and a person. It's not like a pet. They're not a social animal. They don't run in packs. So there's not a demonstrative kind of relationship. And in fact, in medieval times, people always spoke about the peregrine having the air of nobility. And it was that kind of aloofness. It was like an aristocrat.
So it sounds like for this partnership, this bond between the hunter and his falcon to work right, you really have to kind of become part falcon yourself. You have to enter into the mind of the bird and see the world the way a falcon does.
Yeah, and I actually think that I've learned so much about the prey species, too. I really understand them and appreciate them. I see great differences between different species of ducks, for example, and also different individuals. And when I see something, a duck do something brilliant to escape, I just think, wow, that's really good. I'm glad he got away.
So Macduff is, you said, about the size of a crow. How on earth does a bird that size bring down a great big duck?
Well, it's hard. He goes up to really high altitude, and he'll go into a stoop. He'll, like, turn over, start flying downward, pumping his wings to gain speed, and then fold up completely. And he just tries to hit the duck as hard as he can to stun it. And sometimes if he hits it far forward, it'll flip a couple of times in the air, and it might actually crash into the ground and be knocked out or something. And he'll swoop back up, and then he might stoop at it a couple of times when it's on the ground to make sure it's not going to take off. And then he'll go down, and he'll finish it off. He's got a real sharp bill with sort of a serrated edge. They sever the spinal cord with their bill. A mallard is really pretty large for a male peregrine, and it's really a pretty sporting proposition, because a lot of times he'll try to hit one and he'll knock some feathers off maybe, and it'll just keep going.
Is there something beautiful to you about this? A lot of people listen to your description and think, ooh, that sounds really bloodthirsty, but there's beauty in it, I think, for you.
It's probably unusual for someone like me. I mean, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool bird watcher and a conservationist, and I really admire waterfowl. But there is kind of a beauty to me seeing nature like this. It's nature in action. And I think one of the most amazing things in all of nature is the power dive of a peregrine falcon. And it's the kind of thing when people see that, like a bird watcher or someone else, they might see that once in their life, and it's something they'll always remember, the most dramatic, amazing thing, the speed of this bird, the sound of the wind whistling through its feathers, and the sound of the impact when it hits something. It's just awe-inspiring. And I don't care if I don't get any game. I mean, most of the time I come back, I haven't caught anything, but it's just the spectacle of it, I guess, and the relationship with the bird.
Tim Gallagher's memoir is called Falcon Fever. He spoke with Anstrain Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 118A, Good Hunting. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by our technical director, Kirill Owen, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anstrain Champs, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.